Can I welcome very much Devinder Sharma, who is here to address us this morning. I had the pleasure of meeting him in Delhi some years ago, and I have to say I was so impressed with everything he had to say, and it made me confident that I could come back and argue that, you know, if we don't want to impose GM on ourselves, what right have we to be imposing it on developing countries? And we should be assisting them to have a say in whether they are forced to take these crops and food or not. Devinder is a huge expert in this field and has written extensively, lectured, researched, and so on and so forth. We are absolutely delighted that you should be able to come today. Rather than go around without getting them to introduce themselves, which would be very nice, I think we should get ahead because we're pressed for time. So if I may, I'll ask Devinder to speak to us on the issue of GM crops and the developing world.
Thank you very much, Joan. It's really a great honor to be here. And I do remember when Joan was in New Delhi, and I had the great privilege of picking her up from the hotel and, you know, taking her in my small car. And she was so scared. My God, you drive so close to your other cars, you know. And every time I would just pass the, you know, vehicle, she would say, "But God, how do you do it?" I still remember that, and I was always telling her, "Be sure that's how we do it in Delhi." Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here and on this issue, very controversial issue of genetically modified crops. I think what I'll try to do, John, is to talk about little bit about our perceptions, you know, and bring the scenarios before you. And to start with, I'd like to narrate a small story that I've been doing it for quite long now. If you have missed it out, is we had a Prime Minister in India. His name was Mr. Morarji Desai. He's no more, and he was a Gandhian. He was a Gandhian in a lot many ways. So when he became the Prime Minister, one of his unwritten principles was that he will not inaugurate any conference which doesn't have the word rural development in the title. So it so happened that the aircraft industry was planning a conference in New Delhi. And obviously they wanted the Prime Minister to come and inaugurate it. The Boeing and the Airbus and so on, and they wouldn't settle down for the Civil Aviation Minister, and nobody else for that matter. The Prime Minister wouldn't come because there was nothing concerning rural development. So there was a kind of talk pause, and the letters went from one office to another, and finally somebody came out with a very imaginative title. The title was Aerodynamics and Rural Development. I think the industry has picked up from that, and that's what they are doing now. So genetically modified crops and rural development, or genetically modified crops and hunger and poverty in the developing countries. Now this is the same argument which has been stressed by the industry. And Morarji Desai died in the 80s, and I think we have the legacy continues. He of course didn't come for that meeting. We are today in a stage when we are being told that 840 million people go to bed hungry every night, and the number would swell to about 1.5 billion by the end of 2015, so therefore the world needs to produce more, and so therefore we need genetically modified crops. This is one of the arguments. The other reality is that out of these 840 million who go to bed hungry every night, we have the dubious distinction, we means India has the dubious distinction of having one-third of the world's hungry with us in India. 320 million people go to bed hungry every night, and this is what we will normally imagine would be that, you know, there is no food, there is shortage of food. But in reality in India, we are overladen with food stocks. And that's something we'll come down to later. But this argument that, you know, we need to eradicate hunger, and so we are doing a great service to the humanity by bringing in GM crops, is somehow going to do equally more damage, like the Green Revolution technology, which did improve production, but at the same time bypassed the small and marginal farmers. In this particular case, the GM crops will bypass the hungry. That's what our entire understanding is, and we'll come to this later again. I just present to you before a paradox, the global paradox of development. Today the model is, in my country, or whether it's Brazil, Argentina, or the other developing countries, we are being told today that, you know, if you have to economically grow, you need to export food. So the entire process has gone on to cash crops and how to export food. So whether it's Argentina, Brazil or India, the entire focus is on exporting food, not to feed the people or not to go in for sustainable farming practices. Now what has happened in the process is that now the paradigm is, and this I think can be illustrated very well with this particular story which I'm going to share with you, is that in the last few years, the government of India has been inviting two companies. One company is RiceX in America, which has actually developed a technology, patented technology, which converts rice bran into human nutritious food. Now this is something which is still not tested on human beings anywhere in the world, but this, they say, is the answer to malnutrition. So where else you can try this than in India? So this technology that this company has produced is now being touted as the answer to malnutrition. So the government of India has allowed this company to join hands with Monsanto and set up a plant in India where they convert rice bran into human nutritious food. And the understanding is this will address the problem of malnutrition. On the other hand, we have huge surplus of rice lying within the country. That the entire effort is to export that rice. So you have this magical bullets coming in which will address the problem of your malnutrition and hunger, and you're exporting your food outside. Now look at the realities. Ironically, what happens is rice bran is traditionally used as cattle feed. So basically you are converting cattle feed for human nutritious food. And the human nutritious food that we have in India, which is rice and wheat, we are exporting, and when we export it, it goes for the cattle of the Western countries. So we export our human nutritious food, whereas we are importing cattle feed to feed or address the problem of malnutrition food. This is the development paradigm that prevails today in the world. In this particular scenario, why it is more important for a country like India or China or the other developing countries, which I think you'll agree almost all developing countries have about 70-80% of the population involved with agriculture. And whether we like it or not, that's the reality. In India, for that matter, we have, as I've been saying very often, that we have 600 million farmers in India. Every fourth farmer in the world is an Indian. Together with China, we have half the world's farming population. And over the years, the landholding size has shrunk in India. Today, the average landholding size in India is just 1.47 hectares. And if you are rearing a cow in UK or in Europe, you need about an 8 to 10 hectares of land to give that to a cow the kind of feed that it requires. Now, the realities, of course, in developing countries are very harsh, as I said earlier. Now, with this 1.47 landholding size per hectare per family, and the number of farmers, the challenge before us is to see how we can bring in more sustainable farming systems so that these people do not migrate to the cities. They remain on the land. There is no other option. There have been estimates done in India which say, it's done by World Bank, which say that by the year 2010, the number of people migrating from rural to urban areas in India will alone be equal to twice the combined population of UK, France and Germany. And the combined population of UK, France and Germany today is about 200 million. So about 400 million people will be getting out of the rural areas and getting into urban areas. So what happens to the urban areas? Delhi is going to be, is today 40% slums. By 2010, we're expecting Delhi to be 80% slums. And this is because of these kinds of development models that are being thrust upon us. And genetically modified crops is one of the more damaging technology model that is now being enforced. And we are being forced to accept it in the garb of, you know, answering the hunger issue. In India, when we realize that, you know, as I said earlier, we have mountains of food stocks. In 2001 and 2002, the turn of the century, we had a record food surplus that was 65 million tons. And how much is 65 million tons? If you put one bag over another, you can just walk to the moon and come back. That was the quantity of food that was lying within India. In the last 4 years, all that we have done is we have exported 20 million tons out of that. We haven't fed the poor, because the poor do not have the means to buy that price of wheat. And the price at which this food is available is one of the lowest in the world. We can't even imagine. 3 rupees per kilo is the price at which wheat is available. Now, 3 rupees per kilo will, I think, be less than even 10 cents. I don't think anywhere in the world can we provide wheat and rice at such a low price. And yet people can't buy it. So the problem today is the access and distribution, the people's ability to buy that food. But on the other hand, we are being told if we have GM crops, this will address this problem of access and distribution, one. The other thing we have also been told is that GM crops also gives you choices, gives you novel products, which gives you functional products, and these are the products which poor would need. They will have a choice to, you know, look into and see what is good for them. Now, one of those products, as you all know, is genetically modified rice. And this is what is called as the vitamin A rice and the golden rice. Now, golden rice is being touted as the answer to malnutrition, as you all know, micronutrient deficiency, especially in relation to vitamin A. Today, all over the world, we have 68 million people who suffer from vitamin A deficiency. Now, out of that, 12 million people live in India. But where do these people live? These people live in the what is called as the hunger belt of India. And these are the people who cannot buy their normal food requirement. Now, there is an area in India on the western coast which is called Kalahandi, which is very infamous for its hunger and starvation. And every time we get to know of that area is how many people have died of hunger. But the reality is that the area produces a surplus of rice year after year. Yet people can't buy the normal rice they produce. So if they can't buy the normal rice, how will they buy the golden rice? The golden rice will not be available at a price which has mentioned earlier. So how will these people be buying that golden rice if they can't even buy the normal rice? The other thing is we are talking about providing choices to the people. I think given a choice, all that those poor people need is food. And that food is lying in front of their eyes and is rotting. There's no dearth of food in this world today, as we all know. And the micronutrient deficiency that we talk about can definitely be taken care of if we go in for distribution of this food, go in for, you know, adequate diets to these people. But that's not happening. So we are trying to bring in quick fix answer, technology answer, to address this problem of malnutrition and hunger. From this stage, we go on now to the other stage. We have been told this technology comes with more efficient production methods and production systems. And so therefore you need this kind of a model to be adopted, because your farmers are inefficient farmers. And so there is a lot of wastage in quality and so on and so forth, and GM crops will ensure that this is taken care of. If you look at the realities, it's very interesting. In the year 2002, America had the worst drought since the Great Dust Bowl of 1930s. 2002 was also a year when India had the worst drought in the last 100 years. But interestingly, what happened in a country which is known for its precision farming systems, we all know that, in a country which has all the sophisticated technology, the entire agriculture collapsed. When I say the agriculture collapsed, out of the 50 states, 25 states were reeling under drought. Farmers had sold up their cattle, they had sold up their ranches, and there were no fodder for the cattle. President Bush diverted milk worth $150 million to feed the cattle. The water level had gone down. We hear of sprinkler irrigation and the kind of efficient technology they have in America, but everything collapsed in just 1 year of severe drought. That was a sophisticated model of technology. In India, we also had an equally damaging drought in India, but the damage was not as stark as it was in America. We still survived. We didn't have to provide milk to our cattle and so on. But unfortunately, this is the kind of model which we are asked to abandon. We are being told this is not an efficient model. You have to go in for this kind of technology model which comes from America and of course from Europe. And so therefore GM is very essentially part of that system. So you have to go in for genetically modified crops, and these are the crops which will increase efficiency. But I'm sure you will agree, if there's one farmer who is, I think, who is the most efficient farmer today, is a farmer who can go on cultivating and surviving in 1.5 hectares year after year. It's not a small achievement to farm in 1.5 hectares and still to survive with a family of five people and two cattle. You know, he survives. But this is the kind of a system which we need to strengthen. We need to provide them technology, sustainable technology, which are time-tested, scale them up and so on, rather than making increasing the dependence on the external technologies, which already have done damage, which will do further damage. The issue of GM crops is also linked to the environmental protection, they say. They say that, you know, genetically modified crops will mean less of pesticides. And so therefore, this makes the environment clean. But let's look at the realities here. It's very interesting when, if you look at the time of the World War II, we were told that, especially in case of cotton, that you need to spray DDT on it to take care of this bollworm insect in cotton. We started doing that. In few years, the insect became resistant to bollworm. I'm giving this example because cotton is one crop which consumes about 55% of the pesticides all over the world. Only one crop consumes that. So how and why it happened is something that we need to draw a lesson on. So what we did was we brought in the first generation chemical, the insect became resistant. Then we brought in the second generation chemical. It took the insect a couple of years, again it became resistant. Then we brought in the third generation chemical, more potent chemical, the insect became resistant. Then we brought in the fourth generation chemical, which is the synthetic parathyroids, and the insect, just 2-3 years, the results are very good, and then the insect became resistant. And then the farmers began committing suicide in India. So far, we have had 10,000 cotton farmers committing suicide. And this is because of this cycle. And now what has happened is the same industry which was pumping in money for pesticides and telling us there is no other answer for you but to spray more pesticides, and knowing that 99.9% of the pesticides go into environment, only 0.1% of the pesticide really hits the target pest. This was a study which was known. But they went on telling us that this is what exactly you need to do if you have to get out of hunger. And I remember Norman Borlaug, once when I was a reporter, he had come to Delhi, and I remember sitting with him and asked him this question about pesticides. And that was the time also when Rachel Carlson's book, The Silent Spring, had come out. And you know what he said? He said, she is an evil force. And I remember quoting him on this, and he said, these are the people who are opposed to eradication of hunger. These are the people who want hungry to be there. Today the same Borlaug is saying pesticides are harmful, so therefore we need genetically modified crops. Now this sea change has been brought about because the industry which was focusing on pesticides has moved on from pesticides to biological sciences today. So the scientific community has also moved on from promoting pesticides to promoting biotechnology today. Science is linked to industry. That is something that we need to understand. That's why they always talk of sound science. They do not talk of good science now anymore. Mm-hmm. And sound science, as you know, is terminology which cropped up by the industry. Pesticides, therefore, we reached a stage today that, you know, we go on spraying more pesticides and we have created more problems. In the 1960s, only 7 pests were problem as far as cotton is concerned for the farmers. Today there are 70 pests which have become problem in the cotton areas in India. And I have a feeling with the genetically modified crops that number will multiply to 700 insects in another couple of years because of the kind of biological system that it disrupts and then creates the new races. Now that's the kind of system which has already started to happen, and I'm sure in the days to come we'll have a serious crisis on this particular aspect of insect ecology. On this issue of cotton and pesticides, we are being told, look, we brought in BT cotton, and BT cotton has reduced the pesticide consumption, and so therefore the environment is more safe, so why are you cribbing, you know? That's the argument that goes about. But let us look at China, which is the example they always cite. China has about 7 million hectares under BT cotton. The first crop came up in 1999. That was the crop when the average pesticide consumption in China was about 30 kilos per hectare of pesticides on cotton. So it came down to 7 kilos per hectare. So they did the arithmetic, and then they gave us this figure, how many billion dollars saved from pesticides and how much environment is cleaned up and so on and so forth. In 2000, the pesticide consumption rose from 7 to 14. Just in 1 year, the average pesticide consumption rose from 7 to 14. These are the only 2 years for which data is available. For the next 2 years, scientists haven't done the analysis. They haven't done the survey to find out what is the quantum of pesticides now being used in case of cotton. The question comes up, why? Because to our understanding, pesticide consumption has already come back to the same level that is used to be existing earlier. And what has happened? Is that the answer? Is that what we call a sustainable system that we talk about? So now the scientists have moved on. So now they're going in for 2-gene BT cotton. So they had 1-gene BT cotton. Remember, we had first generation of chemicals, the insect became resistant. So first generation of BT, the insect become resistant. So now we're going in for the second generation of BT, that is 2-gene. And we are told that 3 genes will not work. For some scientific reason, 3-gene doesn't work. So now what do we do after 2 genes? We already moved the gene from scorpion into corn. So we'll now have 1 gene from scorpion moving into cotton also. So after 2 genes of scorpion, we'll have some gene being taken out from snake and perhaps put into. So this cycle will go on. After first we did it with the chemicals, now we are doing it with these kinds of insects and animals. I don't know where it will end. And industry has no intention of saying that it ends, because that's where they make profits. So we have actually pushed on. There was in Hindu mythology, if those of us who have read Mahabharata, there is a famous story of somebody called as Abhimanyu who broke through the 7 rings. In the war and went in. You know, that was the kind of a system that prevailed at that time. But if you are able to go, there are 7 rings thrown by the enemies, and you have to pierce that rings and then come out, then you are a victor. So this poor young boy could manage to go in. His condition is same like that of the farmers today. Farmers today have got into the trap now. They can't get out of the trap. And the industry is only trying to strengthen this trap, whether it is by pesticide treadmill or whether it is by biological treadmill. So we have a serious problem on our hand as far as the pesticide issue is concerned. But then coming to the another issue which they talk about, is the issue of seed saving. We have been told that farmers will have choices when they get good quality seed. And I'm sure you have all heard of this Terminator story. But Terminator is something that is now being applied, as we all know. It's no longer a concept. It has already been tried. And even yesterday in that debate, we were told that Terminator will give farmers a choices. They'll give them better seed. But what better seed? If you have to see in our own backyard, we have seeds which can outdo the production levels that we all talk about. When I came out with this analysis, I was challenged by the scientists, and I must share with you, in Bangladesh, some groups have got hold of the kind of community gene banks they have. They have got access to about 1,800 rice varieties traditionally existing. So they cultivated those rice varieties on the farmer's field. First year, they were surprised. They got 57 varieties which actually out-yield the high-yielding varieties. So there was the question mark, is it true? So then a few of us were invited to get into more scientific trials. For the last 4 years, we have been holding trials, and we have found out that there are varieties which can yield as much as 9 tons per hectare without chemical fertilizers. These are the varieties nobody talked about. And these are the varieties nobody wants to talk about now also, because these are the varieties which become the kind of raw material for these private companies. Now, one thing which I'd like to say before I end, John, is this issue of control, private control over genetic resources. In the time of the Green Revolution, if you remember, we were told that genetic variety, genetic diversity we have is being lost for posterity, so we must make efforts to collect, conserve and preserve all these varieties. We did that. Now, this follows earlier. If you remember, America had a president before Abraham Lincoln, and the name is forget, and it will come to strike me, and he was very fond of smuggling seeds. In fact, as long as he was not president, he wrote in his memoirs that he would smuggle seeds because he realized the importance of seeds. And America, as we know, is a country which doesn't have much of genetic wealth originating from within the country. So, when he became the president, the first thing he did was, he sent a circular to Americans all over the world, that wherever you are, please pick up the seeds, whatever you can lay your hands upon, and send a seed sample back to America. Americans obliged. 10 million seed samples came. So he actually put up a body to manage those seed samples, which was formalized by Abraham Lincoln later, and it became the U.S. Department of Agriculture. After that, we realized that in the era of Green Revolution, again the same language, that these are the varieties which have been lost for posterity, so we made all those collections. When we made all those collections, we were told that this is mankind's heritage, so if you keep in India, it won't help. So the rice variety should go to the rice central collection, which was the International Rice Research Institute, so you keep your rice strains there, so every country can help. Very, very right, so we in good faith, we gave our rice varieties to those institutes. But there was one country, and you have to admire the shrewdness, they said, look, if you keep your rice varieties in Manila, or if you keep your wheat varieties in Simet in Mexico City, or potato varieties in Lima, in the 16 CGIAR centers, there's always a chance that some terrorist will come someday and blow it up. So what do? You must keep one copy in safe custody. And so where is the safe custody? Fort Collins in America. So America, what they did was, they had a small air base below the hill. So they cleared that air base, put up a gene bank, and the world became reassured that their genetic resources are safe. So today, the largest collection of plant germplasm, which is about 600,000 taxation, lies in USDA. And this is a collection which is outside the control of the CBD, Conventional Biological Diversity. No, we don't have right any control over those resources. So what has happened is, the plant genetic resources have been taken away. So they are the raw material for the biotechnology industry. The industry has the raw material. America has the money, and America also has the research facilities or the research ability, but they don't know what to do with these plant species. After all, it's very difficult to go to start again and to find out or to draw an analysis of each plant, what properties it has got and what characters it has got, and then to develop drugs on it and so on and so forth. So the best way is to know from those societies which were living with those plant species, what were you doing with these plant species? What is called as community knowledge. So therefore, they're coming back to us now using the same language. Look, community knowledge is getting lost. It is something which has been passed on from generation to generation. This is traditional knowledge which is getting lost. So therefore, it's a loss to posterity. So therefore, we must document it. And this will also help in fighting patents. So this system has been legalized now. You know, if there was a kind of a biopiracy effort, people would always find their scientists and send them back. But now they legalize it, so all donor agencies are pumping in money, asking communities within India or the developing countries to go on for documentation. So a whole lot of documentations are being done, and those copies then come to the companies who need it, and they can then make use of that knowledge to develop the products they want to develop. And then they come with intellectual property rights back to us. It is not going to take 30 years now to draw intellectual property rights on it. Already there is an effort under the WIPO to draw a sui generis system of protection on this traditional knowledge. So even the knowledge that came from our countries is now, we're going to lose control over it. So in that, what exactly the lesson is that we have lost control over our genetic resources. And as you know, just to give an example of India and America, India is home to 45,000 plant species. 45,000 plant species, rice is just one species, it can have 100,000 strains, but it's counted as just one species. And we are home to 81,000 animal species. This is the third biggest diversity that exists in this world. America, on the other hand, is home, but is a place for origin of the plant species. If you look at it, only 5 plant species and 3 animal species originate from America. And you will all agree that you cannot build a superpower on 5 plant species and 3 animal species. So you need to appropriate and misappropriate genetic resources, and that becomes the raw material for the new control measure that is through the biotechnology. To us, that is the emphasis, or that is the thrust of the entire industry to control the entire food chain, which begins by seed, the process of seed. Just to end up now here, rice is a staple food. As you know, one of the most important staple food in the world today is rice. Rice is the crop which comes, as far as we are concerned, we are a place of origin for rice. India is a place of origin. And we know rice has been classified into two categories, Indica and Japonica. And obviously it is an indication where these two strains came from. But today, rice is now gone under the control of private companies. After the mapping of the rice genome, first by Monsanto and then by Syngenta, and then the intellectual property rights that have been drawn, this is a process which is now taking away the control of rice from the people, from the communities, to the companies. And no wonder, in mid-February, the International Year of Rice was inaugurated in Basel in Switzerland. And I had the great privilege of being invited to deliver the keynote there. And I still don't understand, why Basel, of all the places? Well, I think they knew what they were doing, because Basel is now the center for the new wave of rice. Basel is the headquarters for Syngenta, which had mapped the genome and which has now the control over the genes, which is, you know, is trying to map and drop it and so on. So basically, the International Year of Rice gives a toast to Switzerland's emergence on the rice map. And the rice is now gone into the control of Syngenta, and that's what I call rice, as you all know, is called Oryza sativa. And I think the name should be, for practical purposes, it has become Oryza Syngenta. Now that's the process that we are fast getting into. And this not only begins with rice, you'll see other food crops also getting into this trend. So therefore the focus is very clear. With trade, you can displace people, cheaper food will destroy the livelihoods, push the farmers out. On the other hand, technology will take care of the control of the entire food chain. It will block our research, because we now need to have, for the same rice strains that were grown in our backyards, we'll now have to pick up the rice genes for which the patents are lying outside, so we'll have to go begging to them or to seek royalties payments for them. Otherwise, we cannot go in for research, which is what I call as a scientific apartheid against developing countries. So biotechnology does two damages. One, of course, the issues that we talked about. The other one is also it blocks research. And the world is now going to witness what I call a synthetic scientific apartheid, which the process has already begun, because it was in 2000 that we allowed the patenting of microorganisms and the microbial processes. Microorganisms include genes, and microbial processes, of course, we all know, is the way you do biotechnology. So with these patents, with these two things coming in the patent control, it is very obvious developing countries will not be deprived of the agriculture. The ability to breed crops for our own food security will not be destroyed. And that means the food security of developing countries is at stake. The world is now getting clearly divided into two parts. North and South, of course, we all know. But the North will not produce the staple foods. And the South will only produce cash crops. We are always being told to diversify from staple foods to cash crops. So we will be only producing cash crops like tomatoes, strawberries, or melons, which meet the luxury requirement of people in this part of the world. That's the kind of new agenda or the new agriculture that we were all heading towards. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, and I had a great deal to take in, and I think, you know, a great deal to be deeply, deeply concerned about. But thank you very much for a very, very clear presentation. We now have time for questions, written comments, but I'd perhaps we start with questions. Would you like to say who you are and where you come from, please?
Margaret has had been an anti-GM campaigner since 1996. I discovered the other day that if you type GM crops into Google, the first type of things are out of 500,000 pages is one called Will GM Crops Deliver Benefits to Farmers? And it's a type that I put together quite a long time ago. So it does show that actually with no resources, you can achieve things if you're persistent. But having been an anti-GM campaigner for a long time, I still have great difficulty in understanding this patenting issue. How it's possible to patent, I understand, synthetic sequences, GM sequences, inventions. I don't understand still how it's possible to patent genetic sequences which exist in nature. Now, if someone like I still doesn't understand, then clearly the general public is not going to understand that. And I think there's a great need for this process to be described in language which the general public can understand, so that people can begin to appreciate the degree of control that the whole development of biotechnology is beginning to engender. It was assumed, at least I had assumed for a long time, that it was only GM sequences which could be picked. But now you're telling us something very different, and it has enormous implications. So we do need to have some good literature on this, which explains it in clear terms, and then really to get journalists to take interest in this subject. I mean, it seems to me to be an incredible theft. So, you know, I'd be interested to hear what has been done to promote knowledge of this subject, which is in addition to the GM issue.
I think you're very right, Mark. You know, if you look at, especially coming from India, the patenting is a very emotional issue in India. And as long as it was involving basmati rice or, you know, haldi or turmeric and so on, the emotions are very high and strong. But when it comes to gene, nobody understands. So there has been it's very challenging to ensure that, as you rightly said, to take that issue in a common language to the people. And that's something which we are trying to do, but I think more important is to take that issue first to the scientific community. Because scientific community is also not understanding till they start feeding the pinch, you know. And one example I would give is, in the case of rice, the government of India, we have a system called the Indian Council of Agriculture Research, which is the second largest public sector infrastructure in the world in agriculture research. Now they were to go in for one gene of rice, you know, when they're going for genetic engineering of rice, they had to buy one gene. And so they went around the world scouting for one gene. Ultimately, they got that gene from Japan. So they paid 3 million rupees for one gene. That gene didn't work when they inserted in rice. So when it didn't work, there's a system of public audit. That's going to come and question, why did you spend 3 million rupees for something? They don't even know what is gene and so on. The public auditors, I'm sure you'll agree, do not know about genetic engineering. So what the ICAR did was, they inserted that in brinjal, the eggplant. Knowing that it didn't work in rice, but they said at least it will do two things. One, it will justify before the public auditors that everything was done for science. Second thing, it will keep the scientists busy also. So that's the kind of process which is beginning. And scientists have now begun to realize that their research is getting strangulated with this patenting system. So I think that's one education that we also need to do, because I think scientific community is very strong ally in this particular case. And I think they need to understand. They only start understanding when they start feeling the pinch. You know, where the shoe pinch is, the bearer knows. So similarly, now they're getting to know. But I think in the masses, as you rightly said, it's a challenge, and I think we need to do it. And I don't know how it will be done. Maybe we need to give a very serious thought to what you've said.
Yes.
Devinder, thank you very much indeed for yet again explaining these things so very clearly. And
where
I do wish.
Where you come from, please?
Oh, sorry. I'm Patrick Mulvaney, ITDG, UK Food Group. Explaining these things so very clearly, and we do really need to make sure that the message gets transmitted more broadly across government. Noted that in Margaret Beckett's disastrous statement of the 9th of March, that she did not transgress and use the GM crops feed the world argument. I think as a result of pressure from many people, including yourself, for which we're very grateful. However, the Department for International Development is still wont to use those arguments whenever possible. And I think there's it would be interesting to hear your view on how we could improve communication, particularly with that department.
Can I just... Sorry.
Yeah.
No, I thought you'd finish.
Well, I was going to add one more thing, but...
No, that's
okay. But secondly, and when talking about diversity and the importance of diversity and the point that you're making about gene patenting, there is a little known, but much loved by some of us, international instrument that's about to come into force, which is called the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources and Food and Agriculture, International Seed Treaty. And the 40th signature will be, I think, the UK or another EU country on the 31st of March. It will therefore come into force in July of this year. And it has an ambiguous article, but it does say in the Article 12 treaty that no intellectual property rights may be taken out on these major food crops. That's disputed, and it's disputed exactly what that means, whether it means you can't take out patents on a whole seed, an unimproved seed, of course you can, or if you take the gene out, you can then patent that gene. It's very ambiguous, but at the moment, and what the African group and others want to say, it's all there. Now, in what way do you think that we can use the existence of such an international instrument to try and A, communicate what this is all about, and B, actually get into practice, get into legal force, some kind of international ban on patents on particularly those genes that are important for food crops, and important for farmers' rights, and important for livestock keepers' rights.
Yeah. Okay, should I go?
Well, yeah.
I think this is very, very important what you have said. And I just want to say this, there are two or three ways of looking at it. You know, one was, if you remember, when we were going in for this entire negotiations on biodiversity convention, you know, and post-biodiversity with leading to the this seed treaty, there was this pressure from the developing countries, especially led by countries like India, that we should allow the farmers to save seed and to also sell seed. And if you remember, because of this pressure, the law came up which says that under the national jurisdiction you can do it. So therefore, India framed its seed generation system on the line that, you know, farmers can exchange and sell seed. Now this is something which is coming in under a lot of pressure because they don't like this. But the fact of the matter is the governments have to be smart enough to do this kind of initiative, and that I think is something which has to be done domestically. So in our country, we are putting the pressure now, as you rightly mentioned, after learning from this experience, we are now putting the pressure on the government of India to bring in a law which says that anything that is in public domain, you know, these 30 or 40 genera, 36 or how many?
35
genera that are being kept free of control, we should ensure that nobody is able to draw intellectual property rights. So therefore, we need to have a kind of a law being enacted within the country which says that this is not to be done and we will not accept it. But the issue is that while the FAO has said that, or the CPT says that, at the same time, it doesn't point out when countries like when companies like Syngenta and so on have gone on drawing patents on rice. So what do you do? So I think there is no sincerity as far as, because I sit on the CGIAR committee, and I can tell you they don't want to do it. The CGIAR, which has the IPR board of which I am a member, is not at all interested in these issues. They only want to talk about commercial aspects of genes. So that's very clear. And so they may go with all public statements, but when it comes to sitting in the boardroom and deciding, they are not at all talking of social concern. And that's what, you know, was said in the very first meeting that I attended, and where I used my veto power, and they have said this, that, you know, we are not concerned about social issues, we are concerned about the commercial issues. So CGIAR is going ahead with that, and I think therefore for us, all of us, a civil society in different parts of the world has a challenge, a huge challenge on our hands, and as you rightly said, we have to involve the policy makers, we have to involve people at the political level to also understand this, and that can be then done, you know, taken care of easily. Because in India, let's not forget, the Plant Varieties Protection Act that we have, which is just unique, I suppose, I'm sure you'll agree, all over the world, happened because of the political masters. Once they understood what the implication was, they really didn't budge. And I think that is a story, that's something which we need to replicate elsewhere. But I think we'll have to go at the domestic sector.
Can I just say what I was going to say when I thought you finished? And that was that nobody should believe that DEFRA does not entirely share the views of Griffith, and that DEFRA does not make the case. It is constantly referring in answers to parliamentary questions that you know, feeding the world is an important aspect of GM in developing countries. And although Margaret Beckett didn't say it in her formal statement, she did say it when she was responding to questions. And I've been in a series of parliamentary questions with Elliot Moore, which, I mean, they go to Margaret Beckett, Elliot Moore answers them, asking, you know, for their evidence that GM crops can feed the world. And of course, all they do is refer me to the Nuffield Council on Biodiversity.
Yeah.
And then I tried tabling questions that asked them about research which has been looking at the flagship cases that were in that report, analysing them and finding them deficient. And they say that they are not looking at those cases, they simply refer back to the Nuffield.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of pressure that needs to be kept up, because whereas the government has lost every other argument, you know, there's no question, those of us who are very active on this issue have been able to defeat them, with the help of people like yourself, on every case that they have put up for GM crops in this country. But where we have not been able to defeat them, because you can't, in the sense that this is not a definitive matter and they're not giving precise examples, is on this issue, which is very emotive, which is very strongly defended by a number of backbenchers who work on development country issues. They strongly defend GM crops on the mistaken belief that they are the answer to world hunger. So I just urge you, don't ever let up on pressure on
that. Could I just come back on that? Because, I mean, in fact, when she said in her answer, she used the most vague assertion. I mean, she said, you know, somebody, I can't remember who, has told me somewhere that if you could get across it, could grow in salt water whatever, you know, it would save the world.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it was the weakest.
It was appalling.
Presentation.
And I think the reason that it was weak and couched in those terms is due to the pressure that had been put on the department and on Margaret and earlier. And so she has, I would judge it to that extent, she was less confident than of making the assertions that they've made in the past.
Yes.
But she then has reverted and come up stronger when, you know, that was a day of great pressure. I mean, I wasn't even called by the Speaker. So, you know, they were under a lot of pressure that day. But certainly it's their written answers you need to examine, where they admit to nothing. They know nothing, they research nothing, but they still make the assertion.
Mm. Yeah, I'd just like to make some points and also to get some feedback. My name's Angela Ryan, I'm an independent and a student. I just want to bring up this idea of progress, because you talked about the farming community moving into the urban areas and slums building up and things like that. Well, you know, all developed countries had similar things happen in them in the past, and that seems to be sort of, it seems to concur with progress that is how things develop. But at the same time, I do think we need to challenge this idea of what progress is for us now in the 21st century, because old progress, didn't work, and we have ended up in a huge crisis environmentally. And you talked about scientific apartheid, and I just wondered if you could elaborate a bit more on that, and also that it is in fact science that has delivered us the knowledge that we now have to tackle the crisis that we are presented with. So science is a very important factor in all of this, and the environmental scientists are very, very concerned with the WTO and the fact that at the WTO, the only environmental legislations or boundaries that are respected are the ISO 14001, which are pretty loose and vague and more or less let industry do what they want. Although the environmentalist scientists are getting into consultancies now and really, really trying to do some work with the multinationals. And you talked about two parts, North and South, and everybody in the world supposedly doing what they're best at, and that means sort of specialisation and still more transporting of goods and products all around the world, which of course is contributing to global warming. And then the two cultures that we now see on the international stage between the NGOs, the greenies, you know, and the business community, and how they're so segregated, how nobody speaks to one another, they're at different ends of the halls, they stay in different hotels, there's no communication. And if you've got these two cultures, one whose main objective is the idea of progress and that nothing should stand in the way of the idea of progress, like you mentioned the Rise Institute down there, the Indian visit. Oh no, we're not interested, we're only interested in commercialization. This is very, very endemic, very instilled in people's psyche that nothing should stand in the way of economic development. And I wonder if we, you know, if we could cross-fertilize the two cultures more, how could we facilitate that? Because the integration of the two ideologies may provide us with sustainable development. And if we don't get those two cultures talking to one another, it's not going to happen, in my view. And I'd like to get your feedback on that.
Thank you. I think this is a very valid point. And I just want to share with one, perhaps add on to with one example. We have Mike Gale in Norwich. Mike Gale is the former director of the John Innes Center, and he's also the chair of the CGIS ITR committee, and one of the very strong proponents of biotechnology. I just want to give you one. He was in a debate with me on this issue in the last committee meeting, and I told him, I said, you are telling us that we need to increase productivity and production, whereas in India, farmers are committing suicide for producing more. There's a new trend which has started, it's called produce and perish. So farmers produce more, they sit over their food stocks waiting for somebody to come and buy that food, and when nobody comes for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, they ultimately end up committing suicide. And this is not only something confined to India, it is extending right from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Malaysia, Indonesia. This is the entire belt faces the problem of what I call, you know, produce and perish phenomena. On the other hand, our politicians are telling our farmers not to produce more. This is also happening. Because in India, for instance, governments have told farmers not to produce more. They have no space to keep that food grain. On the other hand, you are saying that we need to produce more for the year 2015. So what should we do in the next harvest is my concern. You know, this man thought for some time and then he said, the people who have committed suicide in India or in the other parts of developing countries is a small price that the world must pay for the 2015.
Yeah,
and that's the kind of thinking. And this is what he said. I was appalled. I said, how can you say this? You know, if these people were to die in England, then you will be concerned. But because they are not dying in England and they are dying elsewhere, you think this is a small price that the world has to pay. So that's what is the understanding of the development process that we talk about. So that is what development is all about. You know, that is one. The other issue, the bigger issue that I talked about, I think you're very right. The World Bank, the WTO, and this GM industry, this is all part of the same packet. That's what has happened. I think we cannot see them in isolation. This is a bigger, broader packet which is delivering what exactly you called as the development model that you talk about. And the World Bank for years has been telling us that whenever they give us loan, it comes with externalities, and we know there are about 162 and 163 externalities which come with one loan. And in all these loans, the one thing is very common, that you must diversify your agriculture. Because for the farmers to really grow economically, the only option is to grow cash crops, and that is through diversified agriculture. So you must shift from staple foods to diversified agriculture. That is what they have been telling all developing countries which draw loans from them. But the same model, I'm sure, if that is a good thing for farmers to do for economic growth, I think that is something that Europe and America needs to teach their farmers. Because after all, these countries go on pumping in subsidies to ensure that these farmers are not in loss. So you don't have to pay subsidies if you start growing cash crops. But no, if this model is not, this advice is never given to Europe and to America. Which means the focus is very clear that staple foods will be produced in this part of the world, and countries like ours will produce only cash crops, the crops that meet the luxury requirement of this part of the world. And your bigger issue, what do we do about all this? I think this breakup of dialogue that you call about was very apparent when we went to the World Social Forum in Bombay. There were 100,000 people who collected there in Bombay, and the so-called elite wasn't there, and they wouldn't even notice or try not to notice what was happening at the World Social Forum. There is a fox spot, I think we reached a stage when we are not interacting. But I think the world is now beginning to take notice, because just 2 weeks back in Delhi, the Irish ambassador in Delhi, who, because I understand the Irish has the presidency now in European Union, called a meeting of 22 ambassadors in Delhi for a dinner with civil society groups to talk about how to link up with the World Social Forum process. That's an indication that they are now beginning to realize that we have to link up, we cannot just exclude them. And I think that happens when you maintain your consistency, you continue doing what is what you think is right, and people will begin to take notice. I think that's the only way we can go ahead in this today's troubled economics that we have.
I've got three four now, signifying. We're going to completely run out of time. So if I may, perhaps I'll ask you to put your questions, and perhaps Davinder can make a note and then try and, you know, sum up in response to the four final remarks.
I'll make it quick. We're working on the import of my name's Helena Paul from Econexus. We're trying to work in the GM campaign on GM animal feed. And that takes us to the whole issue of imported animal feed, which of course is increasing and set to increase with the dairy industry in Europe planning to go more and more intensive. The co-op has pulled out of dairy, perhaps partly for that reason. So we're looking at a more and more intensive, more and more import animal feed based agriculture here. And I just really want to raise that and ask you, you know, what ideas you might have for how we could really bring this point home to people and what it means. The conversion of human food into animal feed is another. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I kind of sound like I just want to come back quickly to the point of the government's position and referring back to the Nuffield report. Because when looking at last year's production of the different reviews, in particular the scientific review on GM, I sort of like set in all the time and listened into the discussion. At first there was the request to also really address it in a way that it means it's good for the health. And that should just be sort of part of basically almost a preambular text. But it was a group of scientists, so therefore the question came up, do we actually have the knowledge to say that? And like a lot of the eyes, it's obvious, it's meant for that, and after, but where is it, you know? And so therefore there was quite a discussion, and at the end it was clear that there's nothing which actually shows that, so therefore that whole thing was left out. As a topic from the report. So if you look in the scientific report, it will not say it's going to feed itself. And I feel the way forward might be to really push the government to look at that specifically, because the National Council can't be sort of trusted on that, obviously, as we know. But if the government put the money into an economic report and a science report, and yet it uses the argument of it's going to feed itself as the only thing left for them not to argue, then they should actually put a proper report together on that. Mm-hmm. And
I couldn't agree with you more, but they're determined not to.
Yeah, but I mean, we should be able to put that pressure on. And I just feel like if also like voices from the South could actually like push, and you know, because we have been trying. But if it comes also like from scientists from the South, and hey, dear government, what is this? So it's your argument there. We need a different,
Anthony Elman, agricultural consultant at the Natural Resources Institute. I think the analysis you've given is very telling and very accurate. And like everybody here, I'm deeply worried about the negative impact of GM, the negative impacts we've already seen, the potential impacts yet to come. But it seems to me that we have to be a bit careful not to give the impression that we think that if GM wasn't here, everything in the garden would be rosy, there would be no hunger and poverty would go away. What I really want to ask you is, what is the alternative strategy which we should be proposing? Is there any way in which the potential strengths of GM, potential benefits of food produced at lower cost, possibly less agrochemical use, despite the arguments against that, but is there any way that one can see these potential benefits being harnessed to the interests of the poor?
Professor Anderson, the Gaia Foundation. And what I have to say is what Ricardo was saying, recently the pro-GM scientists have been saying the decision on GM must be made on sound science and sound science alone, completely pushing anyone who has any experience in development and economics, the weirdo greenies, whatever, and the people from the south, people like Devinder's argument, because you're not a scientist working in a lab in the UK, it seems that your argument doesn't count. And how can scientists who work in laboratories in Switzerland, the US and the UK know what the reality is for farmers in India and Africa? They don't know. And they've completely taken the argument away from the rest of us by saying it must be based on sound science. No, it must be based on sound economic and humanitarian reality. And we just need to, and this is for everyone in this room, not just for Devinder, we need to point out to them that they don't know it all, and we know better than them on that issue.
Very quickly,
just related to this, I've been pursuing the issue of gender as a way of questioning the trade agenda, particularly with DTI, and trade takes intellectual property. DTI has set up a gender expert group on trade at this point, but in the most undermining terms at the moment. DEFRA has no gender in its work at all, beyond just its like employment equal opportunity. So if it did have some gender perspectives, it would start to question its whole work. DFID, if you look at DFID's literature in its agriculture department, it admits that women grow 60 to 80% of the subsistence food in the world, and then fails to mention women after that. So it's quite a fundamental way to challenge all these things, to insist on the gender perspective that governments are actually obliged to have across all departments according to their Beijing commitments.
I'd be very interested to hear more myself from you on this. So if you want to, Heidi is my researcher there, if you want to just let her know what your sources of information are, and you know, look at that and see what I can do with anything. Devinder,
thank you, yeah. So there are lots of things which have been said, but I think they were the answers, in fact. Most of them were the answers to what we should be doing. I agree with Helena that, you know, this issue of getting the human food from the developing countries for the cattle here is a very big issue. And I think for that, we need to put pressure now. That's what we are saying, to ensure that localized, you know, the food production systems become localized. And you meet your own food requirements here. We meet our own food requirements there. And I think we'll have to ensure that we break away from this food export business, you know, that we have actually gone in too far in this entire thing. And as you rightly said, the food is being transported to a whole lot of long distances. Look at India. We grow apples in our backyards. And we are getting apples now from New Zealand and Australia and Washington. We have a milk, we are the number one producer of milk, and we get milk from Denmark, you know. And we are a wheat producer, we have a huge surplus, but believe me, South India is wanting to import wheat because that is cheaper. Now these are the kind of realities which we must bring out, and you know, that will of course be a bigger issue in itself. The issue of feeding the South, yes, I think we'll all have to continue with this debate. I think it has made some impact. When people from the South, you know, few of us who have been talking about it and very conclusively establishing that there is no linkage, I think it has brought about a change. Now I understand even the World Bank is going back on this strategy of what they used to think about earlier. And incidentally, I have to present this year's annual lecture for the World Bank, and which means they are willing to listen. That's a very significant change, you know. Otherwise, they were not even, as somebody mentioned, there was a kind of a gap which is existing. But I think now it is slowly and slowly happening because, you know, the message is growing that these are not the realities, and the realities are somewhere else. And I think that is the kind of effort that I think it has come out with all our efforts. And I'm sure people like Joan and Alan here and others have always pushed this kind of agenda, and that is what is helpful. That's what people's agenda is all about. The alternative strategy, I just want to give you one example. You know, in this entire WTO trade and the issue of WTO World Bank and the genetic engineering industry of feeding the world and improving systems and whatever it is, there's one thing which is happening silently in India, and we are trying to bring out a report on that. It is something called as what I call as village republics. We have 600,000 villages in India. Mahatma Gandhi had always talked about village republics, as you know. But there's interestingly a phenomenon which has gone unnoticed, but which is very significant, and which may be the answer to what all we are talking about. 1,500 villages in India have actually put up notice board outside the village saying, if you are a government official, or you're a company executive, please don't walk into our village. And I think this is not a small achievement. And this has happened without any NGO support. It has happened independently in different parts of the country. And I have a small, if you like, I can shoot that to you all. This article, which talks about village republics, and so we got learning from that, and now we think that is the way the world has to move forward. This village republics, 1500, if they grow into 15,000 in the days to come, I think that is what the world's alternative model should be. These are the people who have taken control over the natural resources. This is the basic thing. That is the lesson is, those who control the natural resources can control their destiny. And I think this is what comes out very clearly from these village republics. I would be very keen or willing to share that paper with you all. Mm-hmm. And I think that should be the answer. Right. And 1,500 villages is not a small number. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Tremendously optimistic. Yeah. Great place to end. Thank you very, very much indeed. I'm sure you through the UK Food Group and the Gaia Foundation, you have means of constantly communicating and disseminating information. So we look forward to hearing more and more from you, Devinda, and trying to make the use of it that we can, some of us, in obviously the public campaigns, but also specifically in the parliamentary campaigns. And I will certainly make every use I can.